From KUWR News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Sure, today the idea of a freak show, even the name itself, seems so backward and offensive, and it is. But the scholar Nadia Duerbach says that if you move beyond the idea that people with bodily deformities were victims of exploitation or objects of derision, and you explored the era of the freak show as expressing something deeper about culture, well, there's a lot to explore. Duerbach explores the freak show in Britain in an era when a paying customer could see armless men, hairy women, giants, conjoined twins, half-human, half-animal wonders. She's interested in what these displays reveal about identity, about bodily difference, and the idea of otherness. Her book is called Spectacle of Deformity, and she's joining us today to talk about it. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the scholar Nadia Duerbach is with us to talk about her new book, which explores the era of freak shows in British culture. We probably have to be careful with language today because even the name freak to describe people born with bodily deformities is crass and offensive, of course, but Duerbach wants to move beyond the taboo of language. She argues that these shows, the era of bearded ladies and Siamese twins and giants, should not just be dismissed simply as voyeuristic or that the people in these shows were victims of exploitation. Duerbach is exploring the era of the freak show as expressing something deeper about culture, and there's a lot to explore here. Today in the program, she's joining us. Her book is called Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows in Modern British Culture. Nadia Duerbach is an associate professor of history at the University of Utah. Her first book was Bodily Matters, about the late 19th century anti-vaccination movement in England. And welcome to the program. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Doug.
Let me start, first of all, as I mentioned in the introduction, that it's really easy to dismiss the era of the freak show as kind of unthinkable, hard to really even talk about the language that you use. It's so dicey, all of that. But you say there's something more here. When did you start thinking there was something deeper going on in all of that?
Well, I think it was actually when I saw the movie The Elephant Man as an adult. When I had seen it when it came out as a child, I remember being very moved by it and it being such a wonderful movie. And I think we all remember it because it won Academy Awards.
Yeah.
But after I'd been to graduate school and after I'd been studying the British working class for quite some time, I'd been studying the history of medicine, and I happened upon this movie again, I was appalled by it. It just didn't tell the story that I knew to be true about working class people and about the medical profession in the 19th century. It was a very, I thought, sentimental, Victorian, romantic story. And it takes a while for Joseph Merrick in the film to speak. And when he speaks with this incredibly middle class, you know, kind of posh accent. And I thought, this is not who this man must have been.
Right.
And it really set me on a little adventure, a kind of mystery story to try and figure out, well, who was this person? And that just opened up this whole interesting world of the freak show.
I want to break down the Elephant Man story as you do in the book. It's fascinating because there's sort of maybe more, but there's at least two competing narratives going on here. And we'll talk about that as we go along. But I want to ask you about what did all of this, as you sort of started unpeeling this era, what did it tell you about our relationship to others? Because it seems like it's about these relationships, how we relate to others, how we see identity and otherness. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, these shows are very much about understandings of the self and how self and other are always produced in a dynamic relationship. And we live in a society today in which we're very comfortable with the concept of the normal. But that is something that was produced in the 19th century, in this period that I'm writing about. So I'm interested in people coming to terms with the sense that there is something that might be considered normal, yeah, against which they are measuring themselves. And part of my argument is that happens at the site of the freak show, that one comes to understand what is normal, what is aberrant, what is model in this context of seeing what is not normal.
Mm. So how did we see talk about the creation of the idea of normal. So how did we perceive normal and abnormal before we had the word,
I guess. That's a great question and something we take for granted. But the concept of the norm is a statistical term, and it comes out of the science of statistics, which is born in Britain in the late 18th century. And it's really only in the 19th century that statistics comes into kind of widespread use, and we get the concept of the norm. There's an average, a mean, a something against which everything else can be measured. And that is the moment in which we start to have language like normal, normalcy, normalness. Those words are only really used for the first time in the English language in the middle of the 19th century.
So how did people who had bodily deformities, say, how were they perceived then in a time before the idea of a normal?
Well, there's a long history of seeing people born with disfigurements as omens of bad luck or of misfortune or of the presence of the devil. That's a long-standing ancient and medieval way of thinking about difference. By the time we really get to the 18th century, there's a way in which people born with disfigurements are seen as objects of wonder. So not necessarily as menacing as they might have been in the earlier period, but as fascinating, as wondrous, as compelling, and as a sign of variety in the world, sometimes as a religious sign of the possibility of God's presence in the world and sort of being a maker, kind of constantly remaking and making humanity. By the time we get to the 19th century, people have usually argued that science rewrites those narratives so that by the 19th century, everyone understands physical disfigurement as pathological, as medicalized. And that's not what I argue at all. I argue that the 19th century is still a time very much of wonder and that these shows show the infinite possibilities of the body. Now, it's a time when doctors want to know and they want to be able to categorize and classify someone as suffering from a knowable, scientifically diagnosable condition. But they're not very successful at doing this. It's really only much later in the 20th century that some of these things are worked out in the medical profession. So the 19th century is a time of, I think, profound negotiation between doctors and anthropologists and other scientists who want to be able to classify the body according to things that are normal or aberrant, and a time when the public is actually very much still engaged in the act of wondering about the body. And so the you know, I talk about this as being modern British culture.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'm always interested in is in the presence of the pre-modern, the medieval ideas still very much in a modern moment.
So in the 19th century in Britain, a person who would go to a freak show, they were going not to not to make fun. It wasn't that they were – it wasn't a derisive purpose. They were – there wasn't something there may have been something ugly in some of the motivations, but in general they were going because it was intriguing. It was maybe not beautiful, but wondrous, I guess, is the word, right?
Yes, and I think you've hit on so many different important things. First, everybody went.
Yeah.
The reason I was interested in this as a popular culture phenomenon, it's the really the only thing in the 19th century I can find that absolutely everybody went to. The young and the old, working class, middle class, upper class, royalty went. Queen Victoria brought these people into her home.
Wow.
Rural and urban, and that's a really important divide in the 19th century, that this is not a form of popular culture only found in cities. It's found in the fairgrounds and the wakes and the fairs in all sorts of rural contexts. So we have people from across the class divide, men and women, children, adults, rural and urban, rich and poor, all going to see these events. And so that is really important that everybody went to them. And they went because they were curious. And I think in some ways it's unfortunate that what we've lost today is that sense of curiosity about other people. I think we think that seeing difference and noticing difference is associated with derision. And in some ways, that's a product of the 19th century. It was very hard for people in the 19th century to see difference without categorizing it, without making a hierarchy out of it. And so there was certainly a way in which people were saying, well, you know, this difference is not necessarily a good difference. But on the other hand, I don't think that people were going there to make fun of people. I found no instances where people heckled the freaks, threw things, did anything that was disrespectful. Sometimes people were shocked and fainted and left when something was too horrific. And we have those accounts in the case of the Elephant Man.
Sure.
But I haven't found any instance where people actually didn't want to engage with them. They wanted to touch them. They were sometimes allowed to kiss them, to shake their hands, to have conversations. And the thing to remember about freaks is they were often very well educated, even though they came from the working and lower middle classes for the most part. Because they traveled internationally, they learned multiple languages. They could talk to you in German and French and English and Italian. And they did things as well. They danced, they sang, they performed tricks. They did things that were skillful as well. And so there was, I think, a real engagement that wasn't necessarily going into a room and just staring at someone who didn't interact with you. Hmm. There was definitely an interaction there. And as I said, I really didn't find any evidence of people attacking freaks, except when they were what we call gaffed, when they were fakes and people were upset about being sold a bill of goods.
Hmm. You know, so it sort of brings us back to the Elephant Man, the movie. It seems like it's difficult for us to perceive that era in anything but a modern perspective, as it being anything but despicable. And the impression that the Elephant Man leaves is that these people were going for derisive purposes to make fun. But that's vastly, it's cartoonish. It's vastly oversimplifying it,
I guess. That's absolutely not the case. People were going to see. They were intrigued. They wanted to see something different, sometimes something shocking, something, you know, wonderful, something they'd never seen before. And we have to remember about the Elephant Man that he, his manager, his London manager, Tom Norman, one of the most famous showmen of his day, not some kind of two-bit exploitative drunkard as he's shown in the movie, but really one of the kind of entrepreneurs of the British show world, the P.T. Barnum of Britain. He set up shop right across from the London Hospital. Yeah. He was a shrewd manager. This was cheap digs, but he knew who his audience was going to be. And his audience was not only people from the working class neighborhood of Whitechapel, but the doctors from the London Hospital. So these were not just kind of people walking in, paying a penny and gawping. These were often medical scientists coming to see something that was also wondrous to them.
Mm. You talk some about the history of the freak show, and you point out that the display of bodies, this wasn't new in the 19th century.
Not at all. This is a long history. I mean, one of the, you know, most famous instances from British literature is in The Tempest, you know, where they stumble upon Caliban and they decide that they think they should bring him home to exhibit him. Mm-hmm. So there's a long history of exhibiting anomalous people, whether non-Western people or people with some kind of physical deformity, for profit. And this has gone on since the medieval period, probably since the ancient world as well.
I wonder, can we extend these lessons from British culture outwardly? I mean, what do we know about? It's interesting, for example, you talk about in the book that in France they had laws against freak shows. I mean, in Britain there didn't seem to be, at least in that era, any whatsoever. But there were people who had scruples in other cultures. So how different, I guess, was British culture from in the scheme of things?
Well, the British were obsessed with the concept of free trade in the 19th century. And so they were into minimal government regulation, or so they said. There were ways in which they regulated heavily, of course. But the free movement of peoples and the ability to set up commercial enterprises was so much a part of modern British culture since the Industrial Revolution began in the 1750s. And so there was this kind of spirit of free commerce. Anyone could do whatever they want and sell whatever they want to a willing public. I expected, however, to find much more government interest in these cases. But I really didn't find that happened until well into the 20th century, when issues of labor and movement of people become more important in the aftermath of World War I. But in France, they did quite heavily regulate. The Siamese twins, Chang and Eng Bunker, were not allowed into France for quite a few years after they debuted in the U.S. and in Britain. So compared to other European nations, the British public could see almost anything any day of the week.
What about here in America?
The same thing was true in the United States. I think the really big difference between the kind of U.S. freak culture and the British freak culture is Britain is a much smaller country.
Yeah.
And so that meant that the British population consumed the same set of freaks. So they were all talking about the same group of people. In the U.S., that just wasn't possible. Such a large country, it didn't have as many railway networks. Not everything could be linked together. The rural areas were not as well served by these traveling shows. And so there wasn't necessarily as much of a common culture around freakery as there would have been in Britain at this time.
I want to ask you about we'll get to some particular stories as we go, but what is it how have we changed in our perceptions of bodily difference? And I'm sure that's a whole area of expertise, but maybe it's difficult to put in a nutshell, but what's the thing that sort of rises to the top into the terms of the way we see bodily difference and identity, those kinds of things? How are they changing?
I think for one, there's much less of it today. Yeah. And in part, that's because of new technologies. The technologies of ultrasound, of prenatal detection, has meant that actually there's many fewer babies born with severe disfiguring disabilities or bodily disfigurements. And so there's many fewer people among us who have profound bodily differences. So I think that's part of the story, is that in the 19th century, there would have been just many more people. So I think we're less aware of how one might deal with difference. I think also the disability rights movement that emerged in the 1970s really fundamentally changed how we think about difference, mm-hmm. how we think about ability or disability or the possibilities of the body. And I think in some ways that's been a shift for the better. I think we're much more attuned to the possibilities that the way in which our world is built excludes certain people because of physical difference. So we're much better at wheelchair ramps and making places much more accessible to people. I think the downside, though, of the world in which we live in is I think we're in some ways afraid to acknowledge difference. Mm. That
we look away.
We look away, or we think that we are, I think, very much compelled by the idea of sameness, that we're all the same. There was a recent book that came out called Mutants, which was wildly popular. And at the end, he concludes, oh, we're all mutants of one variety or another. And I thought, well, that's not true. You know, that's a way of sort of making everyone the same. And I think that's something that we lose. I think difference is very valuable in our society. And we've come to a point in which we either look away or we try and pretend that that difference isn't important or significant. And so I think there's something, while I don't want to romanticize the freak show, I do think that we've lost the ability to really perceive difference, value difference, and think about ways in which that can be incorporated into our society in very positive ways.
Nadia Durbach is with us. Her book is called Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows in Modern British Culture. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the scholar Nadia Durbach is with us to talk about the age of the freak show. She's written a book that examines the era when so-called freaks of nature were marketed and displayed to paying customers. Her interest goes beyond the questions of taste and exploitation. She found that these shows revealed something deeper about identity and bodily difference and the idea of otherness. The book is called Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows in Modern British Culture. Nadia Durbach, I wanted to ask you, let's talk more about the Elephant Man. We were just talking off the air, and you said that the Elephant Man was the one of the characters that you wished you could speak to, have a conversation with. What do you want to know?
I want to know if I'm right. My theory about his life, what happened to him, the choices he made, is radically different from everybody else who's written about him. I argue that the exploitation occurred not at the point in which he exhibited himself as a freak, something he willingly chose to do, but at the point when he was taken captive by Frederick Treves and held as a sort of prisoner in the hospital and was forced to undress for whomever came by, to be poked and prodded and exhibited before medical gentlemen. And so my theory is that he chose the life of the freak show because he had actually been living in a workhouse, that most horrific of Victorian institutions, because he couldn't find labor. And he himself understood that the only route out was to find a job and be self-supporting. And that he took that very seriously. It was something he wanted for himself. He had every right to be a dependent upon the state and be paid for and cared for in a workhouse. And he wanted to express his own kind of independent working class masculinity. And he himself contacted people who he knew in the show world and asked to be taken on as an exhibit. And a series of events happened that put him in the hospital in the end. And I think he saw that as a very temporary thing and assumed that he would be able to get back on his feet, contact Tom Norman, his manager, and his London manager again, and get back out there and earn his own keep, which I think was really important to him, as it was to all working class men at that time, to be self-sufficient, not dependent on charity, not dependent on the government. And Treves really didn't allow that, really made it very, very difficult for him to be able to contact anybody he knew. And it's not that I think that Treves, the doctor, didn't think he was doing something important. I think he thought he was providing a charitable home for someone who should not be exhibiting himself. But on the other hand, what Treves did was really exhibit him in a new way. Yeah. He exhibited him to medical professionals, and he exhibited him to the wealthy who came by to look at him and often donated to the private fund that paid for his upkeep. But, you know, this is just my theory, that actually the Elephant Man would have been more happy being the Elephant Man on public display than being in this hospital. He said quite clearly, he knew he was going to die, and he knew he would die in the hospital. And he said, you know, to the people who were caring for him, you know, that I expect that I'll be pickled in alcohol and put on display. And something very close to that did happen to him in the end. His bones have been – he was boiled down. His bones were articulated and put on display, not to the public, only in the pathological museum of the London Hospital's Medical College, someplace I was not allowed entry to.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because I'm not a medical researcher. That was medical.
But you're a scholar. I mean, you're
not the right kind.
Really?
And yeah, and that's really the kind of coda to his story, is that now, you know, not even, you know, for all the money in the world were they going to allow me entrance.
Wow.
So
did they know your theory?
The archivist at the London Hospital knew my theory and, you know, was wonderful to work with, allowed me access to everything in that archive. But that's a separate archive from the London Pathological Museum's Medical College's, you know, collection of specimens, where, you know, I was not a legitimate medical researcher. So this is a long way of saying that I really want to talk to him. I want to know if I've got it right. It makes sense to me in the context of what I know about British working class masculinity and the importance of labor and the role of the freak show as a way to furnish people with labor.
He wanted to earn his own way.
He wanted to earn his own way, and that's what all British working class men wanted. They did not want government relief. They did not want charity from philanthropic associations. They wanted to be able to support themselves and their family. And that's why he checked himself out of that workhouse and decided to exhibit himself as a freak. He really couldn't do much else that would have been profitable labor at the time. Sure. His hands were quite deformed. And so he had worked – he'd actually rolled cigars for a time. He'd worked as a peddler. But it was really quite difficult for him to move around at a certain point. And so he was looking for a form of labor that he could actually engage in. And this made sense to him. And he earned a huge amount of money doing
this. It was quite
this.
A living, I guess.
He earned an enormous amount of money, much more money than the person who managed him along the way. And it was just unfortunate. Someone stole his money at a certain point in his career, and he was really destitute, and that brought him back to London and brought him back to Treves. Treves was the only person he knew how to contact. He couldn't contact Tom Norman at that time. He didn't know how to find him. And so knew Treves was at the London Hospital, so contacted him in a moment of panic when the police kind of arrested him on his return to the East End of London.
Such a different story than the Elephant Man.
It's an incredibly different story. It's not a story of medicine saving sort of this poor, exploited figure. And, you know, I've read all of Tom Norman's memoirs, and they really strongly indicate that this was a real camaraderie between them, a real friendship, that the show world, you know, was a world of friends. I mean, people who are mutually supportive, and that really he earned a lot of money, much more than Tom Norman did.
What did you make of the end? I guess Joseph Merrick did die that way. But it's so romanticized in the film that he had sort of chosen – he wanted to lay down like a normal person and thus suffocated. I mean, what do you make of that end?
Or the whole film is based on Treves' memoirs, and Treves indicates quite clearly that he felt that Merrick wanted to be normal and just wanted to sleep like a normal person. But Merrick knew absolutely that as soon as he lay down, he would have died, that would have cut off because of the size of his head and the mechanics of this, that this would have actually cut off all the airflow and he would have died. So it's very, very clear especially because this happened in the middle of the day. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't at nighttime. It wasn't when he would have been sleeping, that Merrick chose to commit suicide. And everybody says that in one way or another in all the historical documents. It's very clear that everybody, the coroner, Treves, everybody understands that he made this choice and that he knew it would end in death. It's just that Treves interprets this as some way an expression of his desire to be normal. Tom Norman interpreted it as, I need to get out of this place. How am I going to get out of this place? I can't really check myself out. I'm just going to end it. And that, I think, is the appropriate interpretation, that he chose to commit suicide because this life was no longer worth living. And I should say, I mean, he was very sick at that point. And, you know, I think he knew quite well that he wasn't going to get better and his life wasn't going to get any better. And he probably at that point wasn't in a particularly fit state to exhibit himself as a freak either. I think that his body was really deteriorating. Mm. And so I think this was just a very kind of conscious choice that this was it for him. And the life in the hospital really wasn't that fulfilling anymore.
Nadia Durbach is with us. Her book is called Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows in Modern British Culture. Let's go to the phones. Adam is with us in Salt Lake. Adam, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
That's fine. Thanks for having me on the show, Doug.
Sure.
My question for your caller, I'm a photographer here in Salt Lake, and as I studied photo history, I came across a photographer that I really love, Deanne Arbus, and she was famous for photographing freaks, but she had a kind of interesting philosophy about the people that she photographed. She considered them the aristocrats of society. And what she said was that we as normal people walk around every day fearing some traumatic experience, something, you know, like we have nightmares of going out without clothes on or any number of things, but that freaks, people with deformities, people with disabilities or you know, were the aristocrats because they wore their traumatic experience. I wonder what your guest thinks about that idea and how that might have fit in with the concept of a freak show.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and I like Diane Arbus too. That really resonates for me, the idea of what else could happen to you, you know, that you're there with this spectacular body and it's all out there on display. What I also think about when you mention that is that people from the disabled community often talk about everybody else, people who consider themselves to be so-called normal, as TABS, meaning temporarily able-bodied, in the way that it just takes an accident or getting old, frankly, before the able-bodied become the disabled. And I think that really resonates with what you say, that there's a way in which once you've crossed that line, what else can happen? Put it on display. So, yeah, I think that's a great question.
Adam, thanks a lot. Back to the phones. Richard is with us. Oh, sorry, Will is with us in Salt Lake City. Will, welcome.
Thank you. I was curious about what seems to me kind of the modern freak show. I think about the Lloyd sort of society have things like, I thought of Octomom, who had all those children. It was just a big, you know, tabloid thing, or even things like Jerry Springer. And it seems like those are kind of the modern freak show. It's easy to look back and kind of be disgusted by the draw of the freak show in those days. But I'm just wondering if you felt the same impulse that drew people to the freaks that you studied, to the modern, if there's a modern equivalent of that, sort of in, like I mentioned, the tabloids, Jerry Springer, those outsiders.
Let me step in and just say, Will, the phone line isn't great, the extension we have, but did you catch that?
I did,
it's a good question. I mean, the idea of whether or not we still have freak shows and, you know, cable television.
Absolutely. We absolutely still have freak shows. Octomom, I think, is a great example of that. I don't get a lot of cable, so I don't see these shows myself. But I know that there's a lot of shows about people who suffer from dwarfism, Little World, Little Couple. There's a show I came
across. There's a lot of that now.
There's a lot of this. There's a show I came across called Half Tree Man, about a man who suffers from a terrible disfiguring disease that really turns your body has growths that are very much like bark of a tree. I think we're fascinated by
these things. The morbidly obese. There's a lot of that as
well. The morbidly obese. The thing that I find really interesting that connects these shows back to the 19th century freak show is they're all on the Learning Channel. They're all, and I don't want to say masquerading, they all are purporting, as did the 19th century freak show, to be educational in some way and scientific and to teach people about, you know, the possibilities of the body. And so I think they're very much a recreation of that 19th century freak show, which really also claimed to have quite a lot of educational and scientific interest. And I see a lot of the same themes in these cable reality TV shows as I see in the 19th century freak show. So I think that is, you know, a really good comparison. And I think it's important for us to remember that many people watch these shows and don't think of them as, you don't think of themselves as complicit in some kind of voyeurism, but look back at the 19th century freak show and see that as highly exploitative. And I think they're really parallel kinds of viewing experiences.
Thanks very much, Will. And also an email from Bruce, which asked the same kind of question about the modern-day freak show. Let's go back to the phones. Richard is with us in Salt Lake. Richard, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Your guest commented earlier that we may be less involved with those with deformities because modern technology and medicine allows things like ultrasounds to determine deformities in the womb. I'm assuming she means that those babies would probably be aborted. I'm wondering if, though, modern technology hasn't more than made up for that by saving the lives of many people who would have normally died, and in fact creating more individuals with deformities in our society because we have, in fact, better technology where they would have lived rather than died at a young age.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think both things are true. I did mean that selective abortion now takes place when people realize they're carrying a severely disfigured fetus. But I think you're absolutely right that modern technology has made it possible for people to survive who absolutely would not have survived in the 19th century. So it definitely goes both ways. I think that's a great point.
I want to talk about Lalu, the double-bodied Hindu boy, which you told me off the air was your sort of your favorite character.
He's my favorite physical body. The Elephant Man, Joseph Merrick, is the person I'd most want to have a conversation with.
Right.
And Lalu, to be very honest, is a person I'd most like to see.
Yeah.
That his body to me was the most spectacular that I came across. Now, he was born a version of what we now call conjoined twins, except instead of being attached to a full-grown identical brother, he was attached to a parasitic twin, which meant a not fully developed twin who actually had no head but had a complete body that was much smaller, about the size – when Lalu was an adult, this body was about the size of a 6 or 7 year old child, and it protruded from his abdomen. And it had free movement, so it moved its arms and legs about.
Independently
of Lalu.
Wow.
Lalu could not control that body. And so it's an absolutely fascinating body. Now, the entrepreneurs that Lalu worked with were very savvy, and this was spectacular enough, but just to make it more spectacular, they claimed that Lala, the parasite, was a female, so that this was a male-female body. Now, we know that that could not have been true, and many medical doctors actually examined him and claimed that this was not actually the case, that this was a second male body. But throughout his entire career, he was marketed as Lalu and Lala, the double-bodied Hindu boy. But it was clear that, at least for marketing purposes, Lala was supposed to be interpreted as a female.
What was the act like? What happened? Do we know?
I don't know a lot about what they actually did. I have some publicity drawings and photos where it seems what they did was that he would hold the parasite's arms away from the body. So it was absolutely clear that they were actually attached by cartilage. He never did songs and dances. He doesn't seem to have been in that category to do other spectacular things, probably because the body itself was so intriguing. So I think he was there mostly to be looked at.
What was you said it generated a lot of debate about that boundary between the self and the other.
I think the thing that's profoundly intriguing to us about conjoined twins, or what used to be called Siamese twins, is that we have this strong belief that I am me and you are you, but how can I be me if I'm attached to somebody else? And so what does it mean to be truly oneself when there's somebody else clinging to one's body? And, you know, there's all sorts of different ways in which conjoined twins can manifest at the head, at the breastbone, at the back. And so there were all sorts of different kinds of conjoined twins on the freak show circuit.
Right.
And then there were a couple of these parasitic twins, which are a little bit more rare. But they really did raise this question of, well, where does me end and you begin?
This idea of you talk about Cheng and Eng, a bunker. You say people wanted to see the place where the two became one. That they really wanted to see that.
Yes, that absolutely. Connection. They wanted to see that. And there's another act that was called the Two-Headed Nightingale, Millie Christine, and they were sort of joined sort of at this weird part in their back, and people also really wanted to see that place. And so they constructed costumes in which that place could be seen without it being inappropriate, because it was sort of just above their rear ends, yeah, which would not be something you would see on a Victorian stage. And so people were really intrigued in the place of connection. And could that be severed? Could you make these two people one? And of course, there's masses of shows, again, on the Learning Channel today about the separation of conjoined twins. And we think it's imperative that these people be, yeah, separated, right? That how could you exist attached to another person? Because we so value this idea of the individual, the autonomous self. And so I think this was very intriguing to people in the 19th century. Are these two individuals? Are they one person? And what I loved about Cheng and Eng is that they used to sign themselves Cheng Eng, Siamese twins, so that they had this kind of compound identity as well as being quite separate people.
Well, quite separate people. I mean, they got married.
Yep.
It's a fascinating story. It's like they lived these independent lives, yep, yet they were physically
connected.
They had
two households. They had two wives. They had two sets of children. And they alternated between them. So they spent a few days at Cheng's house, a few days at Eng's house.
I did have to ask. I wondered what you thought of the film with Matt Damon and Greg. I can't remember his name now. Have you seen it?
I don't know. What is it?
I'll find out a little bit more about it. It's an intriguing film. They are conjoined twins, and they're seen not as. In fact, they don't at all live their lives as freaks, but completely normal within this New England community. Hmm. It's intriguing.
Oh, it's called like
Greg Kinnear is the name. Stuck on You.
I've not seen it.
No.
I need to see it.
You do.
Yeah,
you absolutely
I need
do.
To
There's
see
another
it.
Chapter there for you.
Yeah, I saw one recently about twins who are part of a rock band, conjoined twins who are part of a rock band, some kind of indie movie, which I liked a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm. Nadia Durbach is with us. Her book is Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows in Modern British Culture. We're going to take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the scholar Nadia Durbach. We're talking about her book, Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows in Modern British Culture. I want to ask about another chapter in the book where you talk about Crow. This is the missing link. A 7-year-old girl from Indochina, I guess, covered in soft brown hair. Where did Crow fit in the scheme of things in the freak show circuit, I guess, first of all?
Yeah, Crow was the act that was originally marketed as Darwin's missing link. And there are many copies of this, but she's the original of this act. And I would argue that she is really important to the history of natural selection, to the history of Darwin's theory, because she really popularized many of Darwin's ideas for a mass consumer public. So I would say many more people saw Crow the Missing Link than would have read, you know, The Descent of Man or On the Origin of Species. Now, the act kind of got Darwin's theory wrong.
Sure.
But it really popularized this concept that was many people felt was implicit in Darwin's work, the idea that some missing link between man and monkey existed out there, one only needed to find it. And she was marketed as this kind of transition species between the ape world and humankind. And, you know, she was, from all accounts, a very charming and lovely little girl. And yet she was covered in masses of body hair. She had extra teeth. She was incredibly flexible in the ways that a monkey might be. And she was often depicted sort of in these jungle environments as if she was very kind of animalistic. Mm. And so she was very intriguing to people because it made sense of Darwin's theory that, okay, we used to be apes at some point and now we're humans. And here's someone who represents that transitional link, which, of course, you know, was not part of Darwin's theory, but that's the way, you know, most people at the time interpreted this.
So was this a theme, this idea of the missing link, the sort of hairy-bodied
The concept of the missing link had sort of circulated quite widely in Western culture in the 19th century, actually largely even before Darwin kind of popularized the theory for people. And so people were well aware of this concept of the missing link. It appears in satire. It appears in burlesque comedy. Mm. It appears in, you know, fairly serious academic enterprises too. I think the skeleton that was called Java Man was believed to be the missing link. And you often actually still hear that terminology used when you watch sort of Nova and you see shows about the development of humankind. Is this the missing link between, you know, Australopithecus and Homo erectus? So it's still a term that we use quite a lot. Yeah. And she, Crow, was believed to be this missing link.
What about the sexuality of the primitive body? Because you write about that some too.
Yeah. I mean, what happens to Crow, particularly later in her career, is she becomes part of a genre of hairy women that are really quite popular at this time. There's two ways of being a hairy woman on the freak show circuit. One is to be a bearded lady. And those women were uniformly white, often portrayed themselves at least as middle-class, heterosexual, married women in kind of high-necked Victorian gowns, very modest, who celebrated their ability to do needlework and all sorts of things associated with femininity. But then there was this other genre of hairy women who were almost uniformly non-Western people. So Crow would be included among them, who were marketed as half animal, half person, and therefore as closer to nature, as more base, and therefore as more sexual. And this is part of a theme of colonial culture as well, obviously, that women in colonized countries were often seen to be more sexual, easy prey for colonizers, more lustful themselves. And so Crow, later in her career, often fell into that category and was sometimes depicted in quite eroticized poses. So kind of reclining on a bed, wearing outfits that were not Victorian high-necked long gowns, but rather costumes more associated with acrobats, dancers, and those kinds of women who are also believed to be sexually available.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Dave is with us in Poland Desert, California. Dave, welcome.
Well, thank you. I was listening with a lot of intrigue to the program. I was wondering if your guest had was familiar with Joel Peter Witkin's photography.
No, please tell me.
It's he openly advertises for circus freaks, takes a lot of photography in Europe, and gives copies of his photographs to the people who will submit to having a photograph taken of them. It's very controversial stuff, extremely beautiful. I was at the University of Utah teaching until 99, and one of the professors there collected one of his photographs and considered bringing him in as a guest artist. Well, we brought his brother in as a guest artist, but it was sort of, he said, we couldn't do this. Could you imagine what would happen if we opened it to the public? The photographs are extremely controversial. They're pseudo-sexual people who do all kinds of manipulations of their body and are really basically freaks. And fascinating, beautiful photography. They're, I believe he lives in New Mexico and was very popular in the Bay Area. During the 80s and 90s. I haven't seen a lot of his work since, but I thought it would be – I just wanted to get your comment on his work.
Well, I'm going to go in search of it now. It sounds totally fascinating.
Well, what about reacting then to the reaction to it, that that it was too controversial? There's still, of course, this taboo. What do you make of that, that it's just perceived as – this gentleman, Dave, called it beautiful, which is interesting. And yet this impression that it's too controversial, that we're in an era that where this is packed with too many, taboos, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that is sort of unfortunate. I think if people make this choice consciously that they want to display themselves, why should we not be invited to look and be interested and curious? Why must that always be seen as abusive or exploitative? And I can see how it might be. I mean, there's obviously certain situations in which people are not consenting adults and are not making these informed choices themselves. But I think if someone chooses to display their wondrous body for you, should we not have an opportunity to look? Looking doesn't always mean passing judgment or negating someone's value or worth. It just means recognizing the possibilities of difference, which I don't think is always a negative thing. So I'd be very intrigued by this work. I'm going to go look for it.
Dave, thanks very much. What is the, it seems like there was another theme in the circuit, I guess, the freak show circuit, which was about dying races.
Yeah.
And you write a bit about that. The Aztec Lilliputians were one. Talk about that.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
When I started the book, the line I was drawing for myself was between shows that are usually called ethnographic shows and shows that I considered freak shows, which were people with actual physical disfigurements. And it became pretty clear to me pretty quickly, sort of the second day of research, that was a distinction that historians had made, that scholars had made. There wasn't a difference at the time. And in fact, it's very important to understand that these so-called ethnographic shows, these displays of non-Western people whose only so-called deformity is skin color or other kind of bodily markings or traits that are not found in European or American cultures, that those differences were seen to be as freakish as having three legs. And it became very clear to me that you actually needed to reincorporate that story into the story of the freak show, because part of the lesson of being normal was clearly the lesson of being white. And of being, certainly in Britain, an imperial colonizer rather than a non-white colonized subject. And so that was not something separate. It was actually absolutely central to all freak shows. And it was not uncommon for, say, a Zulu warrior to be exhibited standing beside someone who had three legs. And those were seen as analogous kinds of acts because they were analogous kinds of difference, non-white, non-normal, non-British forms of difference. And so one of the really kind of intriguing acts were these acts called the Aztec Lilliputians, or sometimes usually just called the Aztecs. And they were initially children, from what's now El Salvador. And they clearly suffered from what we would now call microcephaly, so very diminished brain capacity. And they were celebrated as the last of the Aztec race. And they made the circuit for over 50 years. I mean, they were the longest running act, I think, on the freak show circuit. And I would argue the most popular act of the 19th century, hands down.
Wow.
Yeah, hands down. In their heyday, at least in the 1850s and 60s, their heyday, absolutely the most popular act around. And they were interesting to people because they were the remnants of this dying race. So they were supposedly the last remaining people of the Aztec civilization. And they served two purposes. One, as a kind of look what can happen to civilizations that degenerate. They can disappear, they can shrink, they can become just two dwarfish, imbecilic individuals. But on the other hand, I think they were also a foil against which Britain in particular could measure its own successes. And British public could argue, well, that's not going to happen to us. We are the most modern, advanced, successful civilization and empire out there. We're not going to go the way of the Aztec Empire. So they serve this kind of dual purpose. One is a kind of warning, an object lesson about the decline and fall of great empires. But on the other hand, sort of something one could measure oneself against.
You know, I was interested in the speculation in terms of the Aztecs about the questions of their race and these theories that Aztec and Mayan people were in fact descendants of the lost tribes of Israel, which interested me because it has some resonance in Utah where Mormons sort of believe in this similar concept.
Yeah, there was this really kind of – well, there are two kind of bizarre and interesting narratives that drew me to this act. I'd seen this act over and over and over again when I was looking at all this freak show material and hadn't really been drawn to it until I started noticing that they were always described as looking Jewish or Assyrian. Mm-hmm. And that made me stop and say – what on earth is going on here? And I realized there was, well, this narrative of the lost tribes of Israel in the New World, that some people were arguing that Mexican peoples were kind of the lost tribes of Israel. And so this act, the Aztecs, fit into that narrative. And they were also, described as having sort of Hebraic noses. And I realized that that was actually part of a language of degeneracy in the 19th century, that Jews were the paradigm of degeneracy. There was vast amounts of anti-Semitism in the the 19th century. And so it made sense that this act, which was marketed as a degenerated race, that was the main theme of the exhibition, that these were degenerate people, the last remaining degenerated Aztecs. And so it made sense, actually, to ally them to the Jews, who were also thought to be a degenerate people. But the Assyrian story was even more intriguing to me. I could not figure out for the life of me why people kept saying they looked Assyrian until I realized in the 1850s, when the Aztecs were exhibited, the British were busy digging up all the Assyrian artifacts, which you can now see spectacularly displayed in the British Museum. And the British public was absolutely obsessed with the idea of Assyria as a similarly declined civilization, sort of conquered, but also brought down from inside its own internal kind of sloth and vice and degeneration. And they made this kind of parallel mapping that the Aztecs and the Assyrians were not only the same kinds of civilization sort of brought to their knees by their own internal decadence, but actually the idea that the Assyrians migrated to the New World and formed the basis of the Aztec civilization. I found this so intriguing. And that became the major theme in Britain of the Aztecs Act, that they were descendants of the Assyrians.
About a minute left. I wanted to ask you, you talk about the decline of the freak show in Britain. And one of those that – and there were a number of factors that sort of played into all of this. But I was interested in how – World War One. People started coming back with all these injuries. And I even think about today, veterans now of Iraq and Afghanistan, how did that play into our sense of bodily difference?
Yeah, I think World War One was a profoundly earth-shattering event in terms of the history of the body, because for the first time, people with physical disfigurements were part of every family and community. So previously, one could move through the world without knowing someone who personally who had a physical disfigurement, but that just really wasn't true after 1914. Huge numbers of people came back from the front, missing arms, missing legs, missing parts of faces. And I think that radically reshaped how the British public in particular was prepared to deal with the idea of disability. And the whole concept of the disabled, that term really only emerges in the context of World War One. We really don't have and I've looked long and hard for this. I really don't see that term being widely used in that specific context, meaning, you know, a physically disabled body, until about 1915. And so it really radically transformed how people related to what we might call a non-standard or a non-normative body. And I think from that point on, it really did become much more questionable whether it was ethical or morally responsible to put people with disfigurements on display.
Nadia Durbach. Her book is Spectacle of Deformity, Freak Shows and Modern British Culture. Thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.